Correctly with the correct amount.
D20 Radio, your gamer's role. www.d20radio.com.
Roll for initiative.
Hello, Gamer Nation and folks out there, and welcome to the Roll for Initiative, issue number 16. I am your host, DM Vincent, along with DM Jason and DM Nick. Nick, how was your week in gaming this week?
I actually didn't have much of a week in gaming, quite honestly. Kind of took some time off, but a couple weeks I'll have my next game pretty soon here.
Oh, cool. And Jason, how was your week?
Hey, I've had a good week. This has been a Tetsnibbin week for us, so we'll be back on first edition next week.
Tetsnibbin sounds contagious.
but it was a fun game. But we will be sort of hitting the reset on our first edition campaign next week, so I'm trying to decide whether I'm going to write up something from scratch or to take the players on a practice run through an expeditious retreat module that I'm going to be running at Gen Con this year. So
very
we will
cool.
see.
Ooh. Well, I look forward to hearing about that. My week in gaming was kind of boring. I hadn't played in like a month, and finally we played, and it was third edition, so I was like,
I'm sorry for you.
Yeah, I know. What are you going to do?
Were anyway, you DMing or playing?
I was actually playing, so I had no choice in the matter.
What are you going to do? Your pain.
Yeah. Anyway, back onto track. Facebook, we're booming now, you guys. You see that? 230
yes.
fans. We appreciate everybody that hit that like button. Want to thank you. And if you want to find us, Roll for Initiative in the search box. Or I believe, Jason, you said it for, what was it, facebook.com/RFI podcast, right?
Yeah, that's the direct URL you can type in. So facebook.com/RFI podcast. Or like you said, you can just go to Facebook and type Roll for Initiative. And thank you to everybody who has hit the like button and become a fan on there. There's some really good conversations going on. And so please continue. If you're listening to this show and you use Facebook, stop over, hit like, and you know keep in touch with us there as well.
Definitely. Go to our website, rfipodcast.com. You can read all the articles, comment on the articles. All the authors and the writers appreciate everything you say. They take the feedback and they use it. rfistaff@gmail.com is where you can write us personally. We've had a lot of emails of people just giving us encouragement and support. We appreciate that. Every one of the emails is answered back with a nice little thank you, and we definitely appreciate that. And you can give us a call, 206-279-3272, if you want to leave a quick voicemail saying hi, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or click on Jason's Google Mail. I mean, sorry, Google Voice. And it'll call you right back, and I believe that's about it. Am I missing anything, guys?
Yes, yeah, so that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, let me go ahead and get the bit in here. A couple of things. first of all, we will announce as soon as we have the T-shirts ready, like we mentioned last week, we'll probably have a contest to give a couple of those away. But an important thing, I forgot to give a shout out last week to Kat Chu from the Dragon's Foot forums.
Oh, okay.
When we put up the issue 14 notes, I put a picture and I said, whoever is the first person that can identify the movie that I took this still from. And she was the first to catch it. The movie was, in fact, Gamers. That's Gamers with a Z, or actually yeah. with a Z, because it's a Scottish movie, so they would say it's with a Z. And it's kind of funny because Gamers, there's more than one movie named Gamers, so there's a little confusion. But this is actually the Scottish movie. Mm. You can get it
on
Netflix.
Scottish play.
Yeah. And you can get the movie Gamers on Netflix or, you know, at a lot of video stores. And it's a really good one to check out. So big shout out to her for that. And, Nick, you said that there was something else.
Wait,
that
there's
you give a shout out for.
One thing also, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, yeah. A couple of things just to give everybody out there in Roll for Initiative land a little heads up. We are going to be at Gen Con and Origins this year.
All right.
And specifically, we got Vince and Jason. Mm-hmm. They're going to be at Gen Con. So they'll be doing a show from Indy. So that ought to be interesting. And I will be at Origins this year. So I'm going to try and call in Vince and Jason from there and see how we can coordinate the show and do a kind of on-site report. And I was just thinking if we can get the T-shirts ready to go, we can have our T-shirts ready to go for convention season. And if you folks see us there with our Roll for Initiative T-shirts on, you know, go ahead and say hello, shake our hands. Punch us in the face.
Wow. I mean, I don't know about that, but
no punching in the face, please. But you know, that would be pretty cool. You know, have
someone punch you in the face.
Roll for Initiative, represent. What up, yo?
We should do something for anybody we see with a Roll for Initiative T-shirt at the conventions too. We'll talk about that later.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
There's one last thing I did want to say since you brought up Gen Con.
Yeah, go ahead.
So Gen Con this year, you know, every year the event registration begins early, and it has begun. So I think a lot of people who are listening have probably, if you're planning to go to Gen Con, have picked out the events they want. I noticed this year that there's not enough old school games going. I was a little bit late.
Origins.
Yeah, I was a little bit late to the event registration because I didn't check my email often enough. And by the time I got there, almost all the – actually, all the first edition AD&D games had filled up, as well as some games of Top Secret, Boot Hill. There was Gamma World, a lot of stuff. But that doesn't mean that this is it. I am actually running one game this year, but I'm only DMing one game because I want to really go play in other people's. So I just want to encourage anybody who's listening, if you're a DM and you're planning to go to Gen Con, you can still – register events. I'll put up instructions on the Roll for Initiative website, maybe stick them on the Facebook site too. If you are interested in running a first edition AD&D game at Gen Con this year, there's still time to sign up and do it. We can connect you with some people who make new game adventures. If you want to run one of theirs, you could run an old one, you could make your own, anything you want to do. But whatever you do, let us know because I want to go sign up for your game if you're running it.
Yeah.
Because I want to play more first edition at Gen Con.
I could say the same thing about Origins, too. There's some second edition games, maybe four or six. But other than that, there's not a lot of old school stuff there that I saw. Maybe from other companies, like Call of Cthulhu is always a big draw there. There's a couple Marvel superhero games, D6 Star Wars. But, you know, I've been to both Gen Con and Origins. Any players or GMs out there, if you can't find anything that's to your liking in the schedule, don't worry. You can always find a pickup game.
Yeah,
Always someone willing to play, anything. Always someone willing to run.
Yeah. There's one thing I'm thinking about bringing with me to Gen Con. I found it in an old Dragon magazine. It's called The Dueling Room, and it's a room and all set up for characters to step in and duel. It's got rules set up for character against character, and it might be kind of fun. So I'm going to think about bringing that for some pickup games too.
Yeah, there's tons of games going on, just not enough, and we want more. I mean, if something as obscure as Buffy the role-playing game could be more than AD&D, come on.
Yeah.
There's more Buffy games than there's AD&D games. There's something wrong in the universe going on here. I mean, come on.
I have to agree.
While Michelle...
Come on, RFI Nation. Step it up. Show.
That's
represent.
That's right. RFI Nation.
RFIites?
Represent.
What are our fans
represent,
called?
Yo.
RFIites? I don't know. And, oh yeah, we got to give one more shout-out to Kat from the Dragonsfoot Forum, Jason, because she actually posted up a picture of Jack Chick.
That was
it. That's
right.
Remember that.
Apparently he's a little older than I thought, but he's still around, and she found a photo of him. So
pretty cool. I didn't know he was that freaky looking, but anyway.
I didn't know which one was him, but that's okay. So Kat Chu from the Dragonsfoot Forums, there's another thank you.
And lastly, for this to end this intro, on the Facebook site, there's a little discussions tab if you want to tell us what you want to hear on the show or just want to chat about AD&D in general. And that'll head us into Sage Advice, guys.
Sage Advice.
So, for Sage Advice tonight, we have a letter coming in from Damien Salta. And, Nick, you were a little bit more familiar with the Osric, so I'm going to throw it over to you for this one.
Yeah, sure. Damien Salta, thanks for pronouncing that. I was just looking, I'm like, how do I pronounce that? From the D20 Radio Forum says, I just started trying out AD&D. Using the Osric rules per your podcast suggestion, and I'm curious as how you are supposed to handle armor and item acquisition at first level. I don't think I'm running this correctly when my first level players are able to pay for AC3 armor. How does stacking work with armor? Can an AC7 armor and a shield make an AC of 6 and so on? And also, Damian Solta saying a bit perplexed by this and also has some question on the dexterity mods and how they work as far as armor's used.
All right.
So to answer the question, I looked up my PDF version of the Osric rules, and looking on page 28, the rules are pretty self-explanatory on what first level characters get as far as gold pieces. And it's not really much different than first edition AD&D. I just chose, for example, a first level fighter, and fighter rangers and paladins get 3d6 plus 2 times 10 gold pieces. And I rolled it up, got a roll of 90 gold. And looking on the list to purchase, my first level fighter was able to get a suit of scale mail, a small shield, broadsword, morning star, a light crossbow, and 3 dozen bolts, which came out to 86 gold with 4 gold left. So that sounds pretty good for a first level character. I had a fairly decent roll, but you know, obviously being random, your results may vary. So just throwing that as an example. And that's
Let me ask you a couple questions that really quickly before you go on and start to talk about what that turns out to in terms of armor class and how that works.
Sure.
Yeah.
So you're right. That's a good roll, but it's not atypical. You could definitely end up with that, and it would be very easy for me as a DM to have a backstory for why that character had a pretty wealthy start. I mean, characters come from different classes, so
actually,
that was more upper class character.
Yeah, actually, according to the roll, that's pretty low. You can have anywhere from 50 to 200 gold for a fighter, ranger, paladin starting out. So I rolled 90 gold. So
sure. But when you say you had 4 gold left over, that you had only purchased armor and weapons with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's other things that a player needs to purchase at the beginning.
Yeah.
Do you... Right. You know, so I think once you start talking about the equipment that a player needs to have, you know, for example, in our game this week, we came up against a troll. We were right next to a huge field of wheat and a tree that were very flammable, and nobody had any flint on them because nobody had written it down. You know, nobody had purchased it. So you still have to make sure you've got all your equipment other than just
Sure. Oh, I agree. And I just did that as a quick example when picking weapons and armor.
Sure.
I mean, the 4 gold, if you look through the rules, I mean, 4 gold could buy actually quite a bit of other miscellaneous equipment.
Yeah, so, yeah, it could. You still want to have some money to go on the road with. But anyway,
right, but your first level, too. No, that's okay. But taking that all in mind, that's actually a good point. Your first level, you should be practically dirt broke anyway. That's why you're going out adventuring in the first place to get more money and what have you. But, yeah, I mean... That was just a good example. Now, how's that turns into the armor class issue? Everybody starts with a base of AC of 10, and this is modified through either armor and shields and also dexterity adjustments. So let's take that scale mail is normally an AC 6 for your character. A shield will basically subtract 1 from that, which will give you an armor class 5. And I just threw out there with my fighter, maybe he has a 15 dex, all right?
Mm-hmm.
So according to the Osric rules, you get a dexterity modifier of -1, which means you subtract 1 again from the armor class, and that puts you at AC 4. I think a lot of people get confused if they're going from more recent editions, and Osric and first edition AD&D, the lower the number, the better your armor class is.
And just for can you pronounce the questioner's name again? I forgot.
Damian Solta.
Damian Solta.
Yeah.
Damien's, thank you. So for Damien Soltz's question purposes, you know, best way to think of it is that, you know, armor class is a defensive thing, which is why
yes.
it's expressed in negative numbers.
Right.
And so to his question, can you, as a first level player, quote unquote, pay for AC3 armor?
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, I think after
not.
No.
Yeah, not really. Technically. Not
no.
technically.
No.
You can't. There's not going to be. Armor available to you that by itself gives you AC3, but given your example, yes. First, his question was, does armor and a shield stack, so to speak?
Yes,
it does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But the important thing, and he actually was right on the money here with his question. He said, you know, he started bringing up questions about being attacked from the front and dexterity mods. That's your best case scenario. When you're being attacked from
right.
the front, you have the opportunity to dodge. Because armor class is not just about how well you can take a direct hit, but how well you can avoid it. So that dexterity is only going to work if you see the blow coming, and the shield's only going to work if the blow is coming from somewhere that you could use the shield to defend yourself.
Right. That's exactly right.
Well, here's also his question I was also wondering about, which I forgot to ask, but I wanted to know if maybe he was saying, was that starting or was that after a session of playing? That they had an AC armor of 3, I'm not sure.
Well, that could happen if they, say, said fighter came across a suit of plate mail.
No.
I mean, that could happen.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, I mean, if as a DM you want to put that in there. But I think the main issue for his question here is that, yes, you know, you could end up with theoretically with a really amazing armor class, even starting out from the first level, but there's a lot of things that can come into play, like the shield, like the dexterity, et cetera, that
right.
only work in the best case scenarios. So, and just to be clear, he talked about using the Osric rules. I don't want to confuse any listeners. Osric and AD&D rules are not, you know, they're not at odds here. They're both saying the same thing.
They pretty much are, yeah. I can't see really any.
Well, the
differences.
The main difference between the two of them, and I think Matthew Finch pointed this out to us when we had him on the podcast, was that the Osric rules were written in terms of the open gaming license for D20 3rd edition. So it references that inside of it next to everything. So it may make it a little confusing to new players at first.
Right.
So I think that wraps up all his questions, right?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, if there's anything, any other questions pertaining to that, please come to our website or over on to Facebook and let us know and see if we missed anything. But as far as I can tell, we got it.
Yeah, I have also, I didn't write in notes, guys, but DM Paragon sent us a nice email about creating his own adventure and really detailed. I'm going to finish writing it up and send it over to you, Jason, and you can publish it on the website for him.
Okay, great. Yeah, you know what? That's a good thing to bring up also is that if you're listening to this podcast and if you're not familiar with our website, rfipodcast.com, there's a lot of good additional material there. We have been getting new writers. You know, Todd Hughes has been – I think he was our first regular contributor, but now we have a number of writers, and there's great stuff. Go read it and, you know, comment and talk about it there because – really proud of the people that are writing for the site now.
Excellent jobs.
Yep.
That's going to wrap up Sage Advice for this week, folks, and we're going to move into our poll of the week. So our poll of the week last week was what class do you enjoy playing the most? And we had four options, fighter, cleric, magic user, and thief. It looks
who
like
won?
The magic user took the voting, 18 votes total. For
really?
Yeah, fighter lost by four votes.
Was it close? I looked when I went in originally, but I didn't see the final tally.
I chose cleric.
Magic user 18, fighter 14. The cleric had 8, and the thief had 6.
Oh, poor thief.
So this week's poll, new poll. When you think of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, which creature comes to mind first? We have the kobolds, we have dragons, we have orcs, and we have gnolls. So far, we have kobolds in first with 38% of the votes reporting in, 6 votes. Dragons coming in second with 5 votes. The orcs with 4, and the gnolls with 1. What is your vote, Jason?
Well, my vote, actually, my vote would act, if we weren't going off of the choices there, my vote would be the Beholder.
Well,
but
off of the choices
there, the first thing that comes to mind for me is Kobolds, I have to admit, because for most players, it's the first thing, one of the first things you come up against.
Right.
So that's kind of where I fall heavily on. And because, orcs, while they are a huge AD&D
staple,
I still, it's, when I think orc, I think Tolkien. So because of that divided attention, I have to go with Kobolds.
Good call. And Nick?
Well, looking at the name of the game, you can probably guess what I picked. Yes, I picked dragons. I mean, in my opinion, they are the quintessential monster of the game. That's what everybody either strives to get, runs away screaming mad like, oh, my God, don't let it kill me.
Yeah.
So,
all right, cool. I picked the kobolds also. So you can head right to the site and vote. You don't have to be registered on the site to vote. You can just click. You can comment. I don't think you have to be registered to even make a comment on the articles either. We changed the two now, Jason, right?
I'm not sure. We might, because we want to keep spam off. Well, I think the rule right now is you register and you can comment. After you've been approved for one comment, you never have to get approved again. We just need to make sure that it's a real person because, unfortunately,
yeah,
that's
we
the
don't
way
want wood people.
Jeez.
No wooden people.
Yeah. I know the polling system, you can be a guest and you can vote. So go to the site. Vote.
Typical. Of all the evil creatures in the world, I'd like to find one with table manners.
What are you kidding me? I spent years cultivating the worst table manners on the planet.
Table manners.
All right, guys, we're going to be leading into table manners this week. What do we have for table manners this week, Jason?
God, I don't even know. I thought you were running that one.
Gotcha. Disgruntled players.
Yes.
When I talk about disgruntled players, they're talking about these are the people who come to the table with the attitude, they bring the group down, they don't want to be there, but they're just there because they want to play. So what are the telltale signs so you can take, so you can figure out what these type of players are? What is a way to tell them apart? Well,
a lot of them seem to be in that comic that we looked at a few weeks ago.
True.
Got a good point.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I've been actually pretty lucky in this regard where I've only run into maybe a couple of people that are like disgruntled or, they're just disruptive players too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess you can kind of say disgruntled / disruptive players. And I thought about this and I kind of came up with a list of the different types of disgruntled, disruptive players there could be. One is the rules lawyer.
Yeah.
This
straight
is the
out
person,
of the comic. Yep.
Yeah. This is the person who, if it's not in the rules, if it's not there in black and white, they're not going to stray away from the path. And if you stray away from the path, they're going to call you on it, and they might reach across the table and throttle you. So that's
even beyond that, that particular type of disgruntled player we can see showing up in forums as well.
Yeah.
There was very recently, just about 2 or 3 months ago, somebody who had shown up to the Dragon's Foot forums that his idea of rules lawyering was not just to worry about it being in black and white, but to try to take a rule and the intent and twist it to the point that it was making no sense at all.
Yeah.
And I think, people have probably seen that show up at the table, too, where somebody comes in and they say they've thought of a completely ridiculous situation that if you were reading the rules like a lawyer would work. Mm-hmm. And then they just expect the DM to be required to adhere to that, which, of course, is ridiculous.
Yeah, because if I'm the DM, it ain't gonna fly.
That's the one that there's a quote that I keep on my signature, which I think is probably all you really need to know about that. And it's a quote directly from Gary Gygax, where he said that you should, it's the spirit of the game, Yes. Not the letter of the rules that is important. Never hold to the rules as written, nor allow some barracks room lawyer to force quotations from the rule book upon you if it goes against the obvious intent of the game.
Exactly.
So for that first disgruntled player type, the rules lawyer, the way – maybe we should just kind of talk differently about how you would handle each one. For that person, I mean, maybe they actually are there because they're enjoying the game and they're having fun and they've just interpreted the wrong way. So it may be possible to bring that type of a player back into line either by talking to them a little bit separately or if you want to be a bit more confrontational by becoming a bit of a lawyer yourself and just finding ways to smack them back down.
Yeah, I agree. I would do the same thing as you said, pretty much. Pull them aside if you have to.
Yeah, but hopefully in a case like that, that's hopefully a player that could be just pulled aside.
Yeah, they're usually pretty easy to handle, the rules lawyer. If you just use their tactics against them, they pretty much start shutting up. So,
yeah.
Next,
next? The Munchkin. this is the player.
The stacker.
This is the player who builds the character that is like just the ultimate fighting or magic wielding or God-fearing or super thieving type, whatever you want, or sometimes combination of the whole darn thing.
This is your min-maxer.
Yeah.
This is your min-maxer, your power gamer.
And but I like Munchkin better because power gamer almost sounds like a nice thing.
Yeah.
I call them Munchkins. And we've all dealt with them. And sometimes, you know, I think everybody kind of at one point or another does a Munchkin thing once in a while in a game. And you know, actually, I think after a while that gets kind of boring because then you have no challenges.
Well, look, Nick,
you know, I think that's what happens with a Munchkin player is they made this super uber-powered player character, and there's nothing that can, you know, thwart this said character or, you know, pose a challenge at least. Yeah. And they get bored and they do disruptive, crazy things.
Well, like I was telling you before we were recording tonight with my gaming session that we were playing recently. The group turned into a bunch of Munchkins with the DM because he just kept asking for the stuff and everything the DM was giving to the stuff to them. Such as one of my players had gotten a combat shotgun. I was just like, okay. So I said, okay, then I want a lightsaber. And he's like, all right, you find a lightsaber. I'm like, just like that? He goes, yep. So I was running around with a lightsaber as a paladin.
Well, hell, I want the Death Star.
Yeah, I'm sure you would have gotten that too.
Sweet.
And then
That's one where, you know, the DM could certainly be colluding a little bit or in what's the word I was looking for here, enabling. You know, so in some cases when we're talking about disgruntled or disruptive players, we have to make sure that the DM, it doesn't become an enabler for them. If you actually notice somebody, you know, munchkining, I guess, is that a verb? You know, that's actually a pretty easy one. Just to go head to head on, because as the DM, you control the universe that they're playing in. So if that, let's say that you have a player who is playing a cleric that is really loaded up on one particular type of strength, well, then you just pose challenges to them that are deliberately not going to work against that type of thing. You know, maybe you've posed challenges that really only a druid could handle.
Interesting. What do we have next up? We also have the players, which I don't know how you can classify them, but they're the ones that say you're a DM, much like how Nick, how you run pre-mods that they sent out for first edition.
Yeah.
And they're the players that read it ahead of time, and then they're like, you go down a path and they go, what about that sword?
Oops. Yeah.
What sword? Never mind. You know, what do we classify those people as? Cheats?
Yes. They're cheaters. They're the ones who, you know, read through all the adventures, all the modules, they know everything, and they do not separate player knowledge from character knowledge. And that's where you get in a problem with, you know, with a metagaming aspect at times. So, yeah, I've dealt with those people too. Those people, you know, I guess like the rules lawyer, you could kind of pull them aside and say, hey, you know what, that's not cool. That's your character will not know that. You may as a player know that, but there's no way your character's going to know that. So
yeah, but if they've already read, you know, if you're running them through the Hill Giants and they've already read it, What you're really going to have to do is just on the fly change stuff up.
Yeah.
That's not, you know, the only question then is, okay, it's easy for you to put a trap where there was no trap, to take a treasure away, to swap a monster out, those types of things. It's not so easy for you to change some of the political intrigue that might be going on. For example, if you're running through the sinister secret of Saltmarsh and they know from the beginning what the secret of the haunted house is, well, you know, that kind of spoils it.
Yeah.
But once you move all these things around, you just kind of next have to keep an eye on the player that they're not getting upset that things aren't, you know, quote unquote, working out the way they expected. So I think in any of these cases, the advice to give is don't try to make your player feel stupid. You know, don't make them feel bad for being in this situation. Try to come up with a way that they're still having fun, because the goal of this is not to get rid of a disgruntled player, because you can do that. Just say, don't come back.
Right.
How do you make that person have fun?
Right. Well, one I've identified, I got like kind of a couple more identified here. One is, and I term this the drama queen.
Yeah.
This is the player where it seems every time they get into an adventure or some sort of thing, they have to create some sort of drama around the character that they like to be the center of attention, it seems like, all the time.
Yeah, because they're getting bored.
And if they're not the center of attention all the time in a game, they get pissy. I'm sorry. They use that, but they get a little pissy. And if that's, for me as a DM, I've encountered this maybe a couple of times, and it can be really, really tiring. That's sometimes if they don't listen, if you try to pull them aside, like we always said, and I think most DMs who are cordial and want to have a game for everybody, you want to pull these people aside and say, you know what? Everybody's here to play and have an experience and enjoy themselves here. And sometimes they'll pull the, well, this is how my, I'm just role playing card, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Which,
yeah.
Well, I mean, if their character
doesn't fly
is,
all the time.
You know, but I mean, hey, if their character is a drama queen, then that's actually good. But you could tell the difference between if it's their character and it's just them being
that way.
I'm
just talking about
the player. I don't think I've run into this, though. Tell me more about what a player like that is like. I don't think I've run into
this. This is a player, irregardless of what type of character they play, they always want to be the center of attention. They always want to create some sort of drama, some sort of chaos around them, and always draw the players into it. No matter what character, no matter what game system, they're always like that. So, yeah, I've encountered that a couple of times.
All right.
And it's not fun. And the last one is the backstabber. And this is the person, and they don't have to be thieves to do this. This is the person for sometimes out of the blue, they just kill another player in the party.
Yeah,
because they're bored or something.
And you're going, what the deuce? And that type of person, again, as any good GM, talk to them. But
I think the result for all of them is pretty much pull this person aside.
Right.
You have to
use a three strike rule.
Yeah.
Now, one time, I'm going to warn you away from the table. Second time, I'm going to warn you at the table if you do this.
Mm-hmm.
Third strike, you're out of the game. If you're being a real disruptive player, a disgruntled, whatever you want to call it, you know, because, you know, as everybody here knows, we're all here to enjoy ourselves. The players, the DM, we're here to have an experience and have fun. And no one person should monopolize that, either being, you know, being a jerk at the table.
I think that's fair. I like your three strike approach. There's one other trick that you can kind of use, and this is Jeff Grubb kind of had a statement that he made that made me think about this the other week when he said they were at I forget what convention, but somebody had been complaining a little bit too loudly about how much of a better job they could do running a game than the guy who was there, and he turned to him and said, congratulations, you're running it next year. That's another thing you can do, because in a lot of cases with these disgruntled players that we're talking about, or disruptive players, or however you want to put it, there's something in there that's common, and maybe it's just that they feel like they'd like to see the game running a little differently, or they want more attention, or whatever it is. So in addition to talking to the person that's pulling them aside, something like that, you also might want to give them a shot at DMing one week. Say, listen, I've got a good idea. Why don't we, so that you can kind of get a feel for this or be in my shoes, etc., we're going to run a special game next week. You can run it. And, don't even say it like you're trying to teach them a lesson or anything like that. Just, this is what you're doing.
Yeah.
And when they get to be the one that's DMing and seeing how it looks from the other side of the table, it could affect their behavior later.
Sometimes that works.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't. I mean, I've done it to somebody who said, oh, yeah, you can do better than me. Here. Fine. You do it. Here's the books.
Yep.
Go for it. But that was after I got – I mean, they were obviously – ruffling my feathers, and other people are already getting uncomfortable.
All right.
Other times I'll just say, you know what? I do need to take a break.
Yeah.
But you take the next, campaign, something like that. Sometimes those people say, oh, no, you're doing fine.
Yeah, they'll
sometimes
they'll
get afraid.
Down.
They get intimidated when they get behind that shield.
Well, and sometimes that's enough.
Yeah.
But, there's one other kind of disgruntled player that I wanted to bring up in addition, and that's the player who's just not going along with the program.
Disruptive.
Yeah.
Disruptive or whatever it is. Yeah. And I think I've, brought up before the paladin that we had to get rid of, because he was, on the one hand, he was overplaying the paladin thing to the point where absolutely nobody could do anything. But on the other hand, he was a very different player from the rest of the group.
Was he like constantly doing his own thing?
He was doing his own thing, and he just on a personality level, even from the rest of the people that were playing, just didn't seem to be doing it for the same reasons, wasn't having fun for the same reasons. And, when they pulled the A-team trick and hit the paladin over the head, he took it personally. He really got upset at that point. And at that point, by the time that we were, a couple of games into the problem that was happening, I really was just getting sick of it. This was a problem player that wasn't going to go away. And so at that point, I killed him off. And I really pulled a little bit of DM deity, And yeah. I don't think, honestly, he was that upset to get killed off anyway, because I think he was feeling that he wasn't matching up with the group. And it gave him sort of a good excuse to say, guys, I don't have that much time. That's okay. I'm not going to roll up a new character. Go ahead without me. If he had insisted on continuing to want to play, I think we probably would have come up with an excuse for not being able to play with him.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to cut a guy.
Yeah, sometimes you do. Or sometimes you do, if they get you really disgruntled, the old smackdown from the gods.
Yeah, you throw that big giant foam dice at them.
Yeah. Bolt from the blues, Kazat.
Yeah,
but,
that's...
there are some people that you can just never make happy, and I've seen this at cons all the time. I guess some people think they get carte blanche when they go to a con and act like a jerk when they get to a game. And sometimes you just got to throw those people out.
Have to make one confession. I know we're wrapping up this segment, but coming from the disgruntled player side, since you mentioned cons, there was a con that I was at where I was playing that I was the disgruntled player, because, frankly, it was the most boring game I had ever sat in on. We were there for 30 minutes without anything happening, without any clue what was supposed to be happening. All the players were just staring at each other. And at this point, 30 minutes into sitting at the table, I faked a phone call, got up to take it, and never came back.
Yeah, well
that's okay. At least you're not being disruptive to the other players,
Yeah, and I didn't mess up the adventure because there wasn't anything happening anyway.
And that's fine,
I don't blame you.
Sometimes you just got to make up an excuse to get out of there. And I can see it from the player side, too. Like you said, I've been there, too. But, sometimes you just grin and bear it.
Well, that's how disgruntled players work. The disruptive player just sits there and just tries to throw everything off whack. You try to fix it as a DM. Tell us how you do it, rfistaff@gmail.com, and that'll end our table manners discussion for this week. And that'll head us into our feature of the Creature Feature Theater.
Alright, so for the Creature Feature Theater this week, we're taking a look at lycanthropy. That's right, everything weird. So, lycanthropy is handled mainly in the Monster Manual and Monster Manual 2, and I'm going to just kind of go down through what some of the things we've got, and if I'm missing anything out of the Fiend Folio, you guys can let me know, but I think I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
We start out with the basics, and everybody's familiar with the werewolf, and of course it's there in the Monster Manual, mm-hmm. along with the werebear, the wereboar, the wererat, and the weretiger.
Yep.
Yep.
And then we get a little bit more fun in the Monster Manual 2 with the were-shark.
Yes.
Which I never – it never keeps from making me laugh.
Yeah.
And some other good ones like the fox woman, the sea wolf. But then Roger Moore also put together a good list back in Dragon number 40. He went back to Eldritch Wizardry, which was a D&D supplement, original supplement, and had a whole list of other ones, the were-lion, were-leopard, were-jaguar. The Were Saber, which is a Were Sabertooth Tiger. the Were Dire.
I want
dire.
Stats for that.
Oh, well, they're here. We should – actually, these I think we can probably put the stats up on the site.
Yeah.
The Were Ram.
Ram?
The Were Badger. Were Sloth. The Were Weasel. And I think it's the Were Bison.
Okay, Were Sloth, it doesn't work for me.
Not too scary of a creature.
No. But I think I can outrun it.
Yeah. So what all of these have in common is that as the weird version of this, they're going to be roughly man-sized. So that actually – I have to go back and take a look at a couple of these, like the weird bison, because I grew up in bison country. And I don't recall bison being anywhere near human size. They're massive.
Yeah,
so I
don't think
that works. But for most of the case, with lycanthropy, when you're going up against a lycanthrope of any type, they're all going to have some special attacks. They're going to be very strong, things that they can do. But, of course, the thing that you're worried about the most is what happens if you get bitten by a lycanthrope.
Yes.
Yeah. And the Monster Manual gives us the basics. So you've got a if you take half damage or greater, so if you've got 24 hit points and you take 12 or more hit points of damage from a lycanthrope, you're infected. And then the question
is, that's only humans, correct?
Any humanoid.
Any humanoid.
Oh, I thought it was just humans.
No.
So that's dwarf, elf, halfling, you name it. Even actually a gnoll would be,
gnoll?
So if the gnoll got bitten, I suppose there's a chance of having some sort of weird half-gnoll, half-wolf creature.
Gnoll wolf.
Go up against. Gnoll wolf.
Gnoll wolf, yeah.
Wow, that's
so,
weird.
I mean, really.
Go ahead, Jason.
You can. First of all, you're going to have to take the statistics for if you get turned into one of these and do a little bit of your own working them out. If, for example, your character is a halfling and gets bit by a were shark, I don't think that the resulting shark would have the exact exact stats that are given in the Monster Manual too.
No.
Have you guys ever had a character be bitten by a were anything in your games?
Yes.
Okay.
Oh, really?
So,
I can't.
Did you have the? Did you go through the same the cures and the ways to get rid of it?
Well, I had.
Or did you have other ways?
Well, I used, and I can't find it, and I was looking for it before the show, and maybe you can clue me in, Jason, what magazine. The Dragon Magazine had a great article on this, and I can't find it. Maybe it was a
I got it.
You do? Was it on the whole lycanthropy and the gypsy curse and how to cure it and everything?
No, I don't have the one with the gypsy curse.
That was the one that we used.
Like one, no, I actually just have the one that's out of Dragon 24, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Number 24. It's just called Another Look at Lycanthropy, but it doesn't have Gypsy Cure.
What's the Gypsy Cure? I can't find it, and I'm so pissed because I saw it when we played with it like last week, and it was talking about how the gypsies can curse you, and you can become a lycanthrop through curses, and how you can use Belladonna to cure you. I can't find
that one's in the monster manual, so you're okay with the Belladonna.
Yeah.
I like the Gypsy Curse. I haven't heard of that. But the Belladonna, if you eat Belladonna within the hour, you have a 25% chance of being cured.
Yeah, that's right. That's right out of the DMG, too.
Yeah, but the downside is that even if the cure works, you're going to be incapacitated for 1 to 4 days, and there is a 1% chance to die from poison, which I wouldn't give a saving throw for, because since it's only a 1% chance, I kind of consider your saving throw to be wrapped up into that.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I did find, Jason, in the DMG under the lycanthropy rules, it's on page 22, and it does say that any human player character, humans are the only beings able to contract lycanthropy, bitten for 50% or more of his or her natural hit points, has a 100% chance of becoming a lycanthrope of some type that attacked him or her. Now, that just says human, not humanoid.
And it's interesting because I'm looking at it now that you're bringing this up. It's really explicit. And it's funny because in both Monster Manuals 1 and 2, it says any humanoid creature bitten by a lycanthrope. So you're right. Mm. There's a contradiction.
Yeah.
So don't mean to be a rules lawyer, but...
No, but you know what? It's a good point. I think what I would do personally, and this is I think this is an easy one to say. This is where the DM is going to decide which rule applies.
I wonder.
For my game, I would go with the any humanoid because it would be more fun.
Yeah, that would be more fun actually. But a question: I know there was an errata that was out for. I wonder if they changed that in the errata for the DM guide.
Well, let's find out.
My copy is the ninth printing from 1981, so the errata was already included into that.
Okay, so
I have a few more things to go into about lycanthropy, but I think that particular point is a good one for us to go to our listeners too and to hear back from people.
Go to our Facebook site and tell us what you would do in your campaign for what you. What would you do? Would you go by the DM guide, or would you go for the Monster Manual 1 and 2 where it says that you can be any humanoid?
Yeah.
I would go with any humanoid myself.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear what people do. And actually, for people who would go with the any humanoid, I'd like to hear how they handle things like abilities and stats when you have a different type of lycanthrope. It actually leads to another thing that I found, which could bring a little more fun into it all, if you want. This is going back to Dragon Magazine again, so we're going to non-canonical sources here. But there's a fun article called Another Look at Lycanthropy, where John Matson, and I'm not exactly sure when Dragon 24 came out, so this could be before the DMG was actually published. It's 1979, so it's around the same time.
Right. Yeah, it is.
But he lays out different types of lycanthropy that you could contract. So it basically breaks down to you could either have – and this is something you could roll for. You could decide as a DM kind of where you want to go with this. On the one hand, you've got the kind of lycanthropy that most people are familiar with, which is the chance to – change into that creature only under the full moon or only under stress. And on the other hand, there's the chance to do it at will. So a complete change at will. I should probably read this article a little more carefully because I'm not sure if it's at will or if it's a complete change and there's no changing back.
I thought the at will thing only happened after a certain amount of time with the character.
Yes. Well, it does. If you go by the DMG, that's over a long enough period of time, the character is going to start to assume the alignment of the creature, etc.
Okay,
go on.
But this is just, you know, some things that you can do to have a little bit more fun with it. And in this, he splits it up into the possibility to either have a complete change where you completely take on the alignment and the abilities of the weir creature. So, for example, if you were, I suppose, changing into a weir shark, you would be up to the 10 hit dice and everything else. Another possibility, he breaks them into type A through G, but type B would be to keep the physical attributes that you had, so all of your strength and constitution and everything else, but to take on the mental abilities of the lycanthrope. So your intelligence would change, and your charisma and wisdom would change.
Interesting.
And another one is to keep the mental, but to gain the physical. So with any of these, you know, you could kind of mix it up a little bit. And the reason that these become kind of fun is because some players are going to want to stay werewolves.
Yeah, I
mean, and that's obviously where.
Go
that's
on.
Where. Yeah. That's where what?
What, Nick?
That's where we usually, as DMs, run into problems with people who want to lycanthropes.
Not necessarily. I mean, maybe yes, maybe no. I think if you have a player who is changing into a lycanthrope that is a very different alignment, you know, so if you have. And I'm not going to go to the paladin thing here because we know that if the paladin becomes a werewolf, he's not a paladin anymore. If he becomes an evil werewolf. But let's go with just a fighter. Let's go with a neutral good fighter who then changes into a – I'm going to stick with the wereshark here, a neutral evil wereshark.
Okay.
At that point, I think – because I love the wereshark, right?
Yeah, it's interesting.
Okay. At that point, I think the DM is going to have to decide whether or not to take over the character during the time of the change. So, you know, maybe you do allow the player to say, you know what, I'm going to stay a wereshark, but at those times when the change happens, it's time to change hands on the player sheet, on the character sheet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that, especially if, like you're saying, if they'd become that lycanthrope, and they don't have their mental capacity anymore in their human form. They become more like the were-shark.
I think it's kind of fun, especially if if you've decided not to let the other players know about it, you know, so that it doesn't happen in front of them. Because you can have the whole, I don't know where he went, but here comes a shark. Although I guess, I mean, this leaves a bit of a question, which is if you are a were-shark and you are goaded into changing form in the middle of a desert, what happens to you?
Oh, geez.
You dry up.
I guess so. But, you know, the other thing about werewolves or weresharks or werebears or boars or any other type of lycanthrope is that while they're presented as evil, evil, evil throughout the monster manuals, I think that if you wanted to, as a DM, introduce a type of lycanthrope that was good, that would be pretty consistent with at least legend and history and fiction.
Isn't the werebear chaotic good?
You might be right. Let's take a look.
You know, I thought he was.
Let's see. I've actually got the werebear is chaotic good. So you're even in staying with the spirit of the game then. you know, because
I remembered that without even looking it up. That's sick.
You're impressive. I had to look it up. But, you know, werewolves in history have been sometimes shown as forces for good. Mm. I was reading an account of a Romanian legend of a werewolf that fought the devil, you know, to keep the townspeople safe. And in my favorite books, my favorite book series of all time, the Discworld series, Agula, it's my favorite book series, and I'm getting her name wrong. But she's on the Night Watch, and she's a werewolf, and you know, a very nice one. She just happens to have a lot in common with the dogs that come around and doesn't like.
Well, even the were-boar and the were-tiger, they're neutral. So,
so it doesn't have to be a bad thing. So I think there's a lot of ways that you could let the character, you know, take this as a blessing, not a curse.
Yes.
Awesome.
You should come up with things. You should look at the things that could be difficult for them. Maybe you want to roll some system shocks occasionally, or even as the DMG points out, consider the mental anguish that comes from changing from one form into another on a regular basis. But those are all opportunities for you to really get some good role playing in and to think about means to the characters. So
actually, that's good. You brought that up, the mental anguish thing.
Yeah.
From changing from the lycanthrope and back, and over time, the DMG does elaborate on that, and it gives an option for the DM to roll on the insanity tables. So there's a possibility over a certain amount of time, I guess at the DM's discretion, you know, you can use that option of your character will get a certain random insanity if, you know, these stresses of turning into a were shark or a were boar or what have you, well, it takes its toll on you mentally.
Does the article that you have, Jason, in front of you go on to saying the weaknesses and killing of these werewolves or were characters?
This one doesn't go into that, no. No, this is really just talking about how the character changes into the different Wolf's types Bane, of lycanthropes.
Belladonna, Silver.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. We'll go with the traditional methods. I was just curious if you just quoted that part of the article, that's all.
Anything about the werflumph? Just curious.
The what?
The werewolf.
Werflumph?
What's a werflumph?
I'm just kidding.
I thought this was going to be one of those setups for a joke.
All right, Nick, that's going to cause me to drop you out of the conversation now. So, goodbye. Okay. No, I'm kidding.
The werflumph. Look out.
The one thing I want to say about Lycanthrope in first edition is there's a lot to be left up to imagination. And the good thing about it is you can either follow what's in the DM guide, the monster manual, the article that Jason's quoting, or you can go by movies and history. Your decision, you're the DM.
So let us know which rule you guys follow, humans only or all humanoids, and some of the ways that you handle the changes that occur.
Yeah. And let us know some stories of that you have for players and, you know, characters that came down with lycanthropy and how it plays out in your campaigns.
Yeah, go to the Facebook site, drop us a line in the discussion part or even in the general wall, and so other people can comment. We want to hear what you have to say. RFIstaff@gmail.com is our email. All right, that's going to bring us to our last segment of the night. Some people have demanded this back. Nick, your infamous segment of the Blackstone's Vault. And
they've demanded it.
They have.
They put a gun to my head.
Yes. What did you review for us this week?
Well, this week I am reviewing the classic module by Gary Gygax, Module S1, The Tomb of Horrors.
Blackstone's Vault.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Blackstone's Vault. I am your host, Blackstone, and this segment I will be covering Module S1, The Tomb of Horrors, by Gary Gygax. First published in 1978 by TSR Hobbies, and it is part of the S series of modules. And the recommended levels for this module is levels 10 to 14. And this module was first used in a tournament at Origins 1 back in 1975. Now, a little bit about this module. Now, the basic plot really is, it's up to the DM to decide how the player characters, how the adventurers find out about the Tomb of Horrors by putting some hints, maybe a map somewhere, some legends out there about the tomb, where they could find the Tomb of Horrors. Now, if you're using the World of Greyhawk Fantasy campaign setting, there are several locations that Gary Gygax suggested in the module where you could find the Tomb of Horrors. A few of the places that he suggests are the highest hill on the plains of Ayaz, an island in the Nair Dive, somewhere in the Bright Desert, the western border on the Duch of Geoff, somewhere in the vast swamp, or an island beyond the Sea Barrens. Now, if you have the 83 box set, it does have listed the vast swamp as the actual location of the Tomb of Horrors. But, you know, as any good DM, you could choose wherever you want to put it. So, that's pretty much the basic plot and where the adventure could be located. Now, major NPCs. Well, there's only one, and that is Acerak the Demilich. Probably the most interesting and most devious antagonist in any module that TSR has ever put out. And he's just pulling the strings in the tomb, if you will, while the adventuring party is going through, and I'm sure each one's going to get lost one by one. Each adventure is just going to drop off. So, major encounters. I'm not going to go in much detail about the major encounters of this module, but I could say this. Traps, traps, traps. Just traps all around. I mean, I think the whole thing, almost the whole thing, I should say, is traps. And there's some classic ones here. You have, just from the beginning, there's several false entrances to the tomb that are traps. You have the green devil face. There's the archway of mist. There's the scepter and crown trap. And there are many, many more. So, very much a trap and a puzzle-driven adventure. That being said, there's not that many monsters, and it really doesn't need it. The traps alone will keep your players guessing through the whole thing. So, that being said, some of the good stuff. This is a thinking man's dungeon, by far. You really got to think your way through this thing. Also, you have to be prepared. This was probably the module that set the standard for dungeoneering from here on. I mean, the use of the obligatory 10-foot pole, making sure you got 50 feet of rope, making sure that you have chalk or charcoal, the right thieves' tools, the right spells, the right bit of everything. So if you don't have it, or if you're lacking in something, you're going to pay for it, and probably with the PC's lives are going to be the toll. Yeah, so that kind of leads into the not-so-good stuff. This module has the reputation of being a killer module. It is really a meat grinder for player characters. And one or more PCs are going to die in this module. And it's not uncommon to have a TPK in this thing, a total party kill. Because of the instant death traps that are in this module. I mean, it's just almost every trap is, if you fail, you might die. I mean, just plain and simple. So, if you have players that are more into the hack and slash stuff, that are more into just, killing monsters and looting bodies, they're not going to like this module. And even Gary Gygax said it right in the first few paragraphs of this module, almost those exact same words. So, that's the not-so-good stuff. Some opinions and maybe how you want to run this module. In my opinion, I think Gary Gygax really broke the mold with this module. And this was really early on in the game. You had the Brown Box D&D set that just came out, I believe, in 74. And this adventure was used as a tournament adventure in 1975 at Origins 1. So he was already thinking ahead what's going to be going on with the game. And he wanted to prove a point that not all dungeons are just hack and slash affairs. He wanted to really force the players to think and to really get in their heads how to, get through these riddles, to get through these traps, get through the puzzles. And also to force the DMs to think outside the box when making their own dungeons and adventures. To kind of use this one as the gold standard that DMs should go by. And I think it really is. It is the gold standard that almost every DM should go by, in my opinion. And it's, that being said, it's a must-have for every DM out there. It's not only a good adventure to run, but it's also a good reference to how to design a dungeon that will completely challenge your players. And I mean players, not just challenge the PCs for their abilities based off the stuff they have, but really make your players think. Now, a suggestion that I kind of picked up on at dragonsfoot.org, how to run the Tomb of Horrors, is the idea, the concept of having a false Tomb of Horrors, or several of them. The idea is that maybe Aserak, you know, being the devious demi-lich that he is, and he wants to live as long as he can, made maybe one or two false tombs to lead all these adventuring parties astray, that so they can you know, meet their deaths in the false tombs. And I think that's a pretty good idea. So, you know, you could even base a mini campaign around that concept of the false Tomb of Horrors, and then eventually get to the real deal. So, where can you find this module? Well, you can find it in eBay or Noble Knight Games. I found it on eBay for anywhere in a range of $4.99 up to $45.99. And that's either the original monochrome one or the green covered one. So price is going to vary there. You can also find this adventure in the Realms of Horror compilation super module that was done later on. Basically took all four of the S series and put them in a one book format with a, from what I understand, a pretty lame plot that ties them all four together. But you can find it in there. Now, there also is a Hackmaster version called The Tomb of Unspeakable Horrors, which really takes The Tomb of Horrors to the next level. And I do have that one, and it's a pretty good adventure in its own right. I mean, it takes this, the original, adds a little more things to it, and you know, I think that one's really enjoyable as well. So again, Tomb of Horrors is a must-have for every DM to have in their collection, by far. You gotta have it. And if you're gonna run it, expect to have a very, very memorable time. So, next segment, I will be covering Module S2, White Plume Mountain. So, until then, this is Blackstone signing off and saying, may all your hits be crits.
Well, that was awesome. I really enjoyed that review. Thanks for that, Mr. Blackstone. I mean, yeah. Never mind. That's
well, no, no. Dick leaves, and then this Blackstone guy shows up. The two of them are never in the room together. I think they probably don't like each other.
Yeah, I know.
It's crazy. Really, it's nuts. I don't know. It's crazy.
All right, everybody. Leave us some feedback on the Blackstone Vault, because Blackstone would appreciate that. And also go to our site, leave feedback for all the writers and authors, because that's going to wrap up the show this week. So we want to cue the sad music for this week.
Oh.
Yeah. So, that's going to put a wrap on issue 16, and I think that's all we have to say for this week, and we appreciate all the comments. Give us a call, 206-279-3272 for the hotline. Leave us a message on Facebook, facebook.com/RFIPodcast, or even go to the website, rfipodcast.com. Vote in the poll. Which creature do you think of when you think of AD&D First Edition? And that'll be Vince. That'll be DM Vince signing off for DM Jason and DM Nick, saying keep it original, keep it an old school, and join us next week. Good night, everybody.
Later, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Roll for initiative.